Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta, filling in for Roger Goldman on this Friday, June 6th. It's a beautiful morning here in Old Town Park City. Unfortunately, we won't have our normal meteorologist on for the weather this morning, but looking at the forecast ahead, currently sitting at around 44 degrees in Park City, looking at a high today of 70. There is a chance of showers before noon and a slight chance between noon and 3 p.m., but otherwise looking like sunny conditions. Moving over to the Heber Valley, currently sitting at around 50 degrees, high of 77 today, and similarly, there is a chance for showers throughout the morning and early afternoon, about a 40% chance there over in the Heber Valley. Looking at tonight, we're sitting at lows in the 40s and then shaping up to be just a lovely weekend. In Park City, we're looking at sunny conditions with high of 76 on Saturday and a high of 80 on Sunday. And Heber, it should notch up into the 80s Saturday and Sunday, looking at highs of 83 and 87 with sunny conditions, which should be just lovely out there. Looking at the roads right now, I am not seeing any crashes to report, albeit some congestion a little bit there on 248 heading into Park City and around the 8040 interchange there just east of Kimball Junction. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Utah Highway Patrol Sergeant Curtis Blair. He'll be talking about the uptick in road rage incidents and how to avoid dangerous interactions on the road. Then Park City Councilmember Ed Parisian recaps last night's meeting, which will include discussions on the budget and the city park building. And Park City Ski and Snowboard Cross Country Director Emma Garrard previews this year's Moose on the Loose Youth Trail Running Series. And we'll wrap up the hour with University of Utah's Jake Nelson and our own Director of Development, Sarah Irvin, on how cuts to public media funding may hurt free speech. Jumping into some local news, two more residents have filed to run in Park City's election this year. On Thursday, Jack Rubin filed to run for mayor, and Beth Armstrong entered the city council race ahead of the deadline to file today. So far, Rubin and city council member Ryan Dickey will run to fill outgoing Mayor Nan Worrell's position. Rubin hasn't held elected office in Park City. The retired pension fund manager did run for Utah Senate District 26 in 2018, where he lost to Ron Winterton in the Republican primary. Rubin has co-founded two medical cannabis companies, according to his LinkedIn. He was also a guest co-host on a few of KPCW's podcasts, including Cool Science Radio. Armstrong, the former People's Health Clinic executive director, is running for one of two open seats on the city council, joining the field of six other candidates. Council members Jeremy Rubel and Tana Tolley announced their bids for re-election in May. Diego Zagara, Ian Hartley, Danny Glasser, and Molly Miller have also announced city council runs. Armstrong served on KPCW's Board of Trustees from 2013 to 2021. According to her LinkedIn, she has been the managing director of Elevate with Reef Capital Partners since 2022. In her current alternate role on Park City's Board of Adjustment, Armstrong voted to approve a resident appeal in November, halting Matthew Prince's plan to build an over 10,000 square foot home on Treasure Hill in Old Town. Candidates for Park City's municipal election have until today to file. An August 12th primary will determine the four candidates to run for Park City Council. If three or more people run for mayor, the primary will narrow the field to two. The 2025 municipal election is set for November 4th. In the Park City School District, cleaning up a spilled lunch is an act of kindness to be rewarded. So is breaking up a fight and playing with another student who usually sits alone. KPCW's Christine Weller reports on the staff and students who were honored with the district's first kindness awards.
Treasure Mountain Junior High ninth grader Easton Jones isn't exactly sure why he won one of the We All Belong Kindness Awards, but said it might be because he broke up a fight this year.
Two kids just started like fighting out of nowhere. I got up, went and broke it up and like made sure the guys stayed apart.
Trailside Elementary fourth grader Shepard Williams also wasn't certain, but said his teacher, who nominated him, said he always tries to include others.
There's this one Hispanic kid that always just sits by himself. He really likes soccer and I always just try to play with him.
Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman said all award winners were honored because they model kind, inclusive, and empathetic behavior. She and other district leaders surprised Jones, Williams, and the two staff members with their awards at each of their schools Tuesday morning. The district launched the We All Belong Kindness Awards program in February as part of efforts to stop bullying and foster a culture of belonging and kindness in schools. Honorees are nominated by staff and students and recognized monthly at each of the district's seven schools. The end of the year honors are a grand prize for those whose actions stand out. Huntsman said it was an honor for her to give Jeremy Ranch Elementary staff member Quetzal Morales the Kindness Award, as Morales is her former student.
She's the heart and soul of that school. Kids often will use their dojo points to have lunch with her, and she just exemplifies what we intend this award to be.
Dojo points are given out for good behavior, and students use them to buy prizes. Park City High Assistant Principal Bob Edmiston, who is retiring this year, is the final award recipient. Huntsman said he always exemplifies kindness, but one incident stood out. He cleaned up someone else's spilled lunch.
He was on his hands and knees picking up the lunch, cleaning the carpet, cleaning the windows, still interacting with kids as he was doing that. And he didn't have to do that. As a leader of the building, he could have easily called a custodian, but he chose to take his time to clean up that spilled lunch.
Edmiston said he was honored to get the award from Huntsman. She was the assistant principal at the high school when he began working there.
I just believe in being present in the moment. Every interaction matters. Maintaining that message to our students about every day's a blessing, and today's a great day until tomorrow, which will be better, and treat everyone with kindness.
On campus, he's known for his Mr. Ed Said videos. The postings are an offshoot of the McPullen Moment videos he launched during the COVID-19 pandemic to keep the school community connected.
I started doing weekly videos at home to try to keep the school morale and everyone in the right place as best I could.
Thanks to a donation from the Park City Community Foundation, the staff members received a $1,250 cash prize and the students received $500. Jones said he would use the money to buy concert tickets, while Williams is considering buying a new mountain bike. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
I'm now joined over the phone by Utah Highway Patrol Sergeant Curtis Blair. How's it going today, Curtis?
Hey, I'm doing well, Parker. How are you?
Pretty good for, you know, it's Friday. Always great. So state lawmakers passed a bill last year aiming to, bring additional charges to people who, do road rage incidents here in Utah. But I understand your agency is still seeing an uptick in these incidents. I mean, what are you guys seeing on the road out there right now in regards to road rage?
Yeah, road rage has definitely been an increasing problem, particularly over the last couple of years after the pandemic. And I think that the legislation was an effort to try to have a little bit more of the ability to enforce this bad behavior, to try to stop it, right? So the road rage in and of itself is actually not an offense. What it is it's an enhancement to other bad behaviors such as reckless driving or things that escalate into assault or aggravated offenses like that. So what the road rage legislation does is it basically makes all these offenses enhanceable. Mm-hmm. So the courts have a little bit better of an ability to enforce this bad behavior and hopefully put a stop to it.
Yeah, and at UHP, I mean, what do you all consider the characteristics of road rage?
Yeah, so the statute kind of defines it as it's an offense that's in response to any incident that occurs or is escalated on a roadway. And basically the components to it are that offense has to be done with the intent to endanger or to intimidate the other individual involved.
Yeah, and let's say people are in a situation where it feels like it may be escalating. I mean, what would be your advice to drivers that find themselves in that situation?
So these types of incidents, particularly in the area that I work, which is Summit and Wasatch Counties, happen unfortunately on a daily basis where there's reckless driving or some type of road rage incident. Generally speaking, I'd say for the vast majority of these incidents, it takes two people to escalate it to the point of a road rage. Mm-hmm. So the first point of advice that I'd give is to try to create distance between yourself and this other party, right? If someone exhibits this type of behavior, this reckless driving behavior or starts to escalate something on the roadway, the first and most important thing to do is try to create distance, whether that means, you know, pulling off an exit to try to create space, or even pulling over to the shoulder to just see if that other party can continue down the roadway and get away, right? If you're not within close proximity, that eliminates a lot of the risk associated with these incidents because the person isn't there and able to escalate it any further, right? There are some instances where, regardless of your behavior, they'll follow you and it escalates to that point where you definitely need to get law enforcement involved as soon as you can. Call 911, kind of report the behavior that's happening, and we can coordinate with the local agency to try to have an officer intercept that incident so that it doesn't escalate to the point of something more severe than just, you know, traffic infractions.
Yeah, and as you see all these cases, are there any particular symptoms that jump out to you in terms of, you know, sort of creating these reckless situations?
Yeah, I think the difficult thing when you're in a road rage incident is there's not a lot of verbal communication that can go on between the two parties, right? So what starts as maybe something unintentional as far as a traffic violation can very easily become escalated because the other party interprets the other person's driving behavior as maybe something aggressive, whereas, you know, it may be something that's completely unintentional, which is why creating that distance is very important. A lot of times we'll have people who are involved in an incident like this and their priority goes to following this individual that's committed this offense in efforts to try to apprehend them. And I think that in and of itself can kind of cause an escalation. So the most important thing is to create distance between yourself. If you can get a license plate, if you can get a good vehicle description, that's very helpful to us in our investigation. But the most important thing is your safety. And so just creating distance, pulling over, getting off the freeway, getting off the interstate, whatever you can do to try to remove yourself from that situation so it prevents further escalation is definitely the priority.
Yeah, and for you patrolling the Wasatch Back, are there any areas that stick out to you where maybe drivers need to calm down a little bit, or just where you see kind of a more noticeable incidents in certain areas?
There's a lot of incidents that we have on I-80. Obviously, Parley Summit creates issues with speed coming down the steep inclines, and people are very impatient with semis and things like that. The more urban or busy a roadway is, the more likely that you're going to come across somebody who's in a hurry. And that's, I think, just statistically, the more drivers that there are, the more opportunities there are for these types of incidents.
Yeah, I wanted to ask more of a personal question. I take pride in driving quite slow, but on some of these frontage roads that are single lane, you know, sometimes someone can get behind me and doesn't really appreciate how slow I'm driving. What would you be, and I know there's been road rage incidents sort of related to similar situations. I mean, what would be your advice in terms of should I just pull over?
Yeah, I mean, if you can tell there's an incident occurring behind you and somebody is being very impatient and, you know, creating a hazard by following you too close, that's probably the best thing that you can do is just hold the shoulder and let them go about their business.
Yeah.
And call 911 and report that driver. You know, if you can get a license plate and you can kind of explain what you observed and what you saw, then hopefully we'll be able to find them down the road and we can still take appropriate enforcement action. But then we bypass the possibility of having anything escalated between, you know, these two parties.
Yeah. Anything else you wanted to mention just on tips for drivers handling road rage incidents?
No, just that I, you know, anecdotally, I've definitely had my fair share of road rage investigations just within the past year up here. And they can escalate, right? You never know what the headspace the other driver's in. You never know if they're armed. You never know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely advise anybody who finds themselves in one of these situations to not take it upon themselves to try to handle it, to call 911, and just try to create as much distance as possible. That's, in my experience, been the best outcome for these incidents. Where they become pretty troublesome is when the driver or the victim of the road rage feels that they'd like to confront the other driver, and then things can escalate. I mean, we've had a couple instances across the state where this has turned into a pretty serious problem. And it's escalated from just a traffic situation, you know, with different violations on the road to assaults or even to homicides. So just be cognizant of that and, you know, get us involved as early on in the process as you can so we can try to do our part in intervening and not letting it escalate to that point.
And again, the best number for people to call if they want to report a situation is 911.
Yep, absolutely.
So I did want to ask you, I understand there was sort of a close call on US 40 here at the beginning of the month that impacted or potentially got close to hurting a trooper. Anything you can share about that?
Yeah, no, I just watched that body cam video a little while ago, and it's kind of harrowing to watch, especially as someone who's been in those situations.
Yeah.
Being on the side of the road is something that we've become very comfortable with because it's something we do during the course of our job on a daily basis. But it is definitely very appreciated by us when the traffic on Main Flow Interstate is willing to slow down and give us a little bit of space, right? The things that lead us to stop on the side of the road can be varied, whether it's a DUI investigation, just a routine traffic stop, or whether we're helping somebody with mechanical issues. And so that's one thing I'd impress on people's minds to keep to be cognizant of when they're driving up on a vehicle is that you won't really know the reason that that emergency vehicle is stopped ahead of you until maybe it's a little bit too late. So slowing down and creating space for us is something that we very much so appreciate and helps keep us safe.
And that trooper was safe, correct? Nothing. I know it was a close call, but nothing serious happened.
Yeah, no. So that trooper, the vehicle that the near miss happened with actually pulled over right after it happened, and the trooper was able to make contact with them and talk to them. Fortunately, nobody was hit, nobody was injured. But I think that what had happened is the vehicle in front had hit the brakes and they weren't paying attention. They kind of lost control. But fortunately, nobody was struck, no vehicles, no people, and it ended up all right.
Yeah. Is there any law that, restricts drivers from or encourages drivers to move over the lane when there is a police or a highway patrol vehicle on the side?
Yeah, so it is also a law that whenever you're approaching an emergency vehicle that you A, reduce the speed of the vehicle. That's kind of in the language of the statute a shall. Mm-hmm. You need to reduce the speed of your vehicle and provide as much space as practical. And then in addition to that, if the lane adjacent to you is free, you're also required with due safety of, the traffic conditions to move over a lane and create a lane of space. And actually within the last year, that law has expanded to not only law enforcement, but also to emergency tow operators and even just motorists who are driving and may have a flat tire and have turned on their hazard lights. So that law extends to essentially any vehicle that has flashing lights on the side of the road. If they're pulled over, the statute is the same, where you're required to slow down and make as much space as possible. And then if that adjacent lane is clear, to make a lane change to try to provide a little bit of space.
Good to know. Finally, Curtis, I know this is some of the busiest times on our roadways, just heading into peak summer season. Any other tips you want to share with drivers or things people should remember as they head out on the road more?
I would say to just be patient, right? Especially when we approach these holiday weekends and have a lot of people up in our areas recreating up in the Uintas or coming out and enjoying the reservoirs in our counties. You're going to see the roadways be a little bit congested. And I think that one of the primary contributing factors to road rage is people who just don't have the patience to understand that it's going to take a little bit longer, right? Mm-hmm. So try to plan accordingly. And, if you're running a little bit late, just realize that's the nature of the beast when there's more people up in the mountains enjoying the county and the amenities that it has to offer. So just be patient.
Well, appreciate you joining us today and sharing.
Okay, no worries. Have a good day, Parker. Thanks.
You too. We've been speaking with Utah Highway Patrol Sergeant Curtis Blair. Getting back into some local news, Heber City's Public Works Department jumped into action to rescue 10 lost ducklings from a storm drain. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the local farm store adopted the sole survivor.
Heber City Mayor Heidi Franco applauded the sewer team for their big hearts after they jumped into a storm drain in early May to fish out a family of ducks who'd gotten stuck. Franco said a local called Public Works on a cold, rainy day to report the brood was struggling to stay afloat.
Public Works came out, and it was actually Stephen LaFay, who's not with us, that jumped into the storm drain and started fishing out the ducklings, got them all out, but only one survived. But the one that survived is still alive, and we're glad for that.
Franco shared a note from Matthew Kennard, the city's Public Works director, who said his team did everything it could for the little birds.
It was heartbreaking, but we worked hard to warm up the little ducklings, and losing so many was hard, but I'm grateful that one survived.
The surviving duckling was adopted by an employee at the nearby Tractor Supply, who reports he's living with a few other baby chicks and doing well with his new family. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
I am now joined in studio by Park City Councilmember Ed Parisian. How's it going today?
It's going good so far. It's still early, so you never know.
Still a little early. Well, Park City Council had a relatively short meeting last night compared to the usual. Started things off with the final budget review that'll be approved next week. Anything you want to highlight in the budget that stands out to you?
Not really there. It's budget specific. We had higher sales tax revenues the last few months, so they were able to give people a cost of living adjustment.
About 2.5%
for everybody across the board, I think it was. So that's good, or at least the higher, I'm not sure exactly, but everybody got one this year, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, feeling more, a little more confident about the economic outlook after seeing some of those sales
sounds
tax numbers.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't bad before, it was like even, but things are coming in a little higher, so that's kind of nice.
Yeah. Well, moving on, there was a work session about the kind of future of park and rides in the Queens Junction area, looking at that Gordo lot, which is along 248 there across from Richardson Flat Road, and then also the Richardson Flat lot, which is a bit more out there towards Wasatch County, but off of Richardson Flat Road. Didn't seem like there is kind of a clear consensus yet on what the path forward is on improving one of those or both.
Not yet. One of the questions was, are we ready to decide? And I'm like, we're not there yet. There's a lot of questions. You know, at the park and ride at Richard Flat is relatively in its infancy since we kind of picked it back up and tried to push a little bit. And then, you know, I asked, has it ever been totally full?
Yeah.
And the answer was no. So I'm like, well, let's try to fill it first before we spend millions and, you know, tens of millions of dollars on something that we're not really sure if we can change the behavior or not, you know?
Yeah.
So let's go with that. Let's give frequent service. Let's put comfort station out there and let's give it a whack this winter and see what we can do. And I think eventually the path forward will become clear once we see how that works. But in the meantime, they're going to work. We're going to still work on the Recreate 248 bus rapid transit stuff. So I think we're moving along with, you know, we got parking spots out there and they're not full.
There's
yet,
a lot. So, I believe it's like 700.
Right.
And it has grown a bit in recent years, right?
Absolutely.
And in terms of amenities, is there any sort of consensus on what you'd like to see out there in terms of bathroom or maybe a convenience store?
I don't think we want to build anything permanent out there yet till we decide where we're going. But a restroom would probably be a good thing. A heated restroom would probably be very
nice. I know
nice
they have some
there,
things
right?
set up out,
Those royal
out there.
Things, but
when
right now, just kind of going slowly on it. We got to fill the spots up first before we.
When you look at that Gordo property, you know, a lot of things have been discussed for what could go there. I mean, where are you kind of at in your mind in terms of what you think would be the best use?
Of that spot?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, the Public Works needs to move at some point. Transit needs to move at some point. They're outgrowing their spaces, so that seems to be a logical spot out there. So I don't know where we want to go with that yet. I've looked at the data on a park and ride. It doesn't necessarily. There's issues with that spot just as much as there are issues with the Richardson Flat lot. So I'm kind of doing the homework here.
Yeah, to be decided.
Yeah, there's lots of moving pieces, you know.
Certainly. Well, moving on to the other main arterial road, State Route 224, there was a brief update from High Valley Transit and UDOT about their bus rapid transit project. But I understand last night's discussion was really focused on just the medians there that, you know, if you're driving into Park City past the White Barn, they're kind of those median landscape medians in the middle of the road. And you all were asked if you wanted to keep those or not.
We're asked if we wanted to keep them. make them smaller or eliminate them. And unanimously, we decided we wanted to keep them the same width as they are, because it brings that, you know, when you drive in and it's not this big highway and you've got the median and they're not like perfectly manicured, it gives it that mountainy kind of community feel. And we all thought that was worth adding an extra few feet on the side of the road to widen. So we're going to keep the medians.
Yeah, and I know High Valley Transit's been very assertive about pushing this project forward, but I know you were expressing a little bit of opposition just to the proposed road widening.
Well, I was asking, because I said, well, why are we going to fool with the medians inside of Meadows Drive Light if we may not be widening those roads, which...
They told you that wasn't the conversation.
No, that's a done deal. I'm like, and so the guy from UDOT, Mr. Stewart, was there, and I said, is this a done deal? And he kind of like went around and around, and so I don't know, you know.
I understand there's a future discussion. I believe it's at next week's meeting. Yeah. It'll be back for more.
I mean, UDOT has the right to do it. It's their road. A lot of locals and councils don't believe that maybe it's warranted, the time savings. Even if you get on that bus, you've got to get off the bus to get to the resort. So you got to get off the bus, waiting for another bus in the cold with all your stuff. And actually, it seems to me like it's going to take longer to get there. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to save a whole lot of time, if any. So, I've talked to a lot of locals. They're not psyched to have a big, wide road coming in. So, kind of out of our hands at this point. We've expressed our opinions, and UDOT, I think, pretty much is going to have the final say on this one.
Yeah, I think High Valley Transit has said, I believe it's 17 minutes, they said, under it, you could get from Old Town to Kimball, but that's under the full build-out and widening.
Right. Most of the savings comes from Kimball to the canyons. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where it really backs up, and after that, with the lights...
I feel like it opens up more.
It opens up a lot. I mean, it's steady, but it moves.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't lose any time driving except till you get into town where the bus rapid transit lane ends, coincidentally. So I don't know.
More to come next
more
week.
More to come, right, on that.
The council also approved a new water rate structure for, I believe it's single family and irrigation rates. Anything you want to touch on with that?
Only that about 90% of the local water users will get a reduction.
It's kind of designed to penalize those top 10% of users, in effect.
So I think it's fair.
Yeah.
If you overuse it, you get a penalty, then you have a choice to reduce your water and get down there with the other 90%. So I think it's fair. I know Councilor Rebell did a lot, and Scirocco did a lot of work on this stuff behind the scenes, so...
Yeah,
I think the locals should appreciate all that. They're going to get a little reduction.
Yeah, moving on, the council was asked about a $4 million budget shortfall for the city park building. Already had allocated $15 million, but the cost estimates came back around $19 million.
Yeah.
And so you all decided to continue to fund that using the lower park RDA money.
I mean, it's unfortunate, but it wasn't any big mistake. They just didn't consider a few things. And then there was some things about the sewer line. They originally thought they could use the existing sewer line, but then we're told they couldn't because it makes a 90-degree jog, and they didn't want that. So that added $1 million to the cost and then the contingency. So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
We're in too deep.
Already kind of baked.
We got to build this thing. So, yeah, the funds are there. So there won't be any added expense to the taxpayers. So let's build it and enjoy it.
Yeah, I know you're a big recreation guy. What excites you about that project?
That we're getting it done? I mean, I was on the RAB, and I was on the subcommittee that worked on this in 2017, I think. And then they took the funds to buy Treasure Hill. Mm-hmm. Not that that's a bad use of funds, but...
Yeah.
And then it came back. Originally, it was going to be a senior center. They had half of it was all laid out. We had it all figured out, and so that all went kaplooey. So now we're gonna build it.
Yeah.
It'll be good. It's going to be nice.
Moving on, a lot of letters to the editor flying around right now with election season upon us. Last night there was a resident who gave public comment and said that she felt targeted by some comments you had made on social media. Do you just want to respond to that?
Oh, yeah. You know, during our public comment that we're allowed each night, I said, you know, please be civil. Candidates, don't let people support you that with lies and mistruths. And, you know, it's already begun. There's been three, I think, pretty shameful letters, in my opinion. I think they borderline on bullying. And I called one of them out because it was, her letter was full of lies, had the meetings all wrong, had all the facts wrong. And, you know, I go back a minute. I'm a big fan of non-bullying, you know, let's put it. My younger sister had a big birthmark on her cheek. And excuse me about this, but when she was born, and the bullying she got was just relentless. And I had to withstand it all. And I swore I'm never going to let anyone bully. And, you know, it involves imbalance of power. When I was working at Nike, and I'm a hockey ref, I take safe sport every year for 20 years. It was always impressed on us that it's the receipt of the behavior, not the intent of the behavior. So when I receive something and I, you know, put it through my head and I say, oh, there's an imbalance here because I didn't get a chance to respond on this, there's lies in there, there's accusations in there, I think I'm being bullied. And if I think I'm being bullied, as you know, then I need to be respected for that. And this person comes in and complains about me calling them a bully. So it's like the bully calling someone else the bully. It's like, this is typical bullying behavior. You deflect the, and in my response, calling her a bully, I laid out all the facts. This is where you mistook. This is where you're wrong on your accusations, on your truth. This never happened in the meeting. And I even went back and listened to the whole video of that meeting, and none of it ever happened. It was about the nonprofit committees. You might have been at that meeting. It was, unanimously agreed with the committee except for one that was duplicative. They were asked to reallocate that $50,000. They were happy to do it. Everybody was happy. And then I hear that it's shameful behavior. We disrespected the committee. And I'm like, I don't remember that. So I went back and listened, like, it never happened. So to me, that's just bullying. There's no need for that. You want to tell the truth, fine, I can deal with it. But you're going to come out with lies and accusations based on those lies, then I kind of have to draw the line. It's like, I didn't sign up to be bullied. I never gave consent to be bullied just by being on city council. I'm a person first, and I have a right to defend myself. And of course, the bully didn't like that and called me out. And the funny thing is, you remember a few meetings ago, a couple other people called out councilors, and we had a discussion at that point that said the mayor was going to stop that when they saw it on public comment, and coincidentally did not say a word last night. So it's just getting out of control. I mean, it makes me sad. You know, I come in all doughy-eyed. I'm like, oh, I want to help. I want to get elected. I want to do this. And then you get this stuff. And now it's like, it's disheartening. It makes me sad.
Well.
You know, and I don't know.
Yeah.
And elders chiming in, and I don't even want to go there.
Well, we are just about out of time, Ed. But anything else you want to mention? Can we expect some news on the 5 acres soon?
Well, yes, you can, I think. We had the interviews, so we're ready to announce, I think, a winner and get going on this thing, which, by the way, people, will not look like the renderings that you've seen. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be awesome. So,
all right. We've been speaking with Park City Council Member Ed Parisian. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Ed. Park. It's good to see you.
You too. Now joined in studio by Park City Ski and Snowboard Cross Country Director Emma Garrard. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Parker. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, here to talk about the Moose on the Loose race series that starts this weekend.
It does. It starts on Saturday, 9 o'clock race start at North Round Valley Trailhead.
And I understand this is it a four race series in total?
Yes, it's four races. We have a race in July, one in August, and one in September.
And yeah, outside of Round Valley, where else?
Quinn's Junction, and then lower RTS trails, cool. And then Utah Olympic Park.
And is this more designed for youth or open
yeah,
anyone?
Yeah, it's 14 and younger.
14
so
and younger.
Three and up, and generally those young three-year-olds and four-year-olds, their parents will run with them often, which is really cute to see. And yeah, it's just about getting kids out there and active, and it's really cool to see so many kids excited about running.
Yeah, and I think I was looking at it seemed like each race kind of had different tiers. I mean, what are we looking at in terms of distance and like elevation gain?
Yeah, so there's recommended race distances based on your age, but there can be some flexibility there based on ability. So the mini moose, those are where those three, 4 or 5 year olds race, and then you go up to the junior moose, which is usually 7 and up. They do 3 kilometers, so just under 2 miles. And they also, the terrain gets more challenging with the longer races also. And then the Mighty Moose, this is more for your, fifth grade, middle school kids. They do a 5 kilometer race.
Yeah. What is the cost in terms of one race, or is there a package?
Yeah, if you sign up for the full series, you get a discount. It's $80, and if you sign up per race, it's $25, so fairly affordable, and any proceeds go to support our youth programs.
Yeah, where can people go to sign up?
Yeah, so go to parkcityss.org to sign up, and if you sign up before noon today, you get the $25 price. It does go up after that just because we're trying to organize everything, so please sign up today if you're going to sign up.
Yeah, and just again, where's the race is in North Round Valley, that's tomorrow?
Yes.
What time?
9 o'clock is a start, but show up, 30 minutes, hour before to get your race number and get ready to start.
Yeah, and I assume you'll be going through that area, so maybe just bikers or hikers be aware that that's going on.
Aware. We're on it's a mix of single track and double track, so we'll just be on a small portion of some of those trails. So things like Happy Gilmore and Tin Man, you might see some runners out there, so just be aware.
Yeah, sounds like a good time. Anything else you want to mention?
No, yeah. Thanks for having us on. And if you are too old to race, we are in need of volunteers, so you can always come out and volunteer. And that's a great way to be part of the community. And we are also doing the race number pickup today at Rendezvous Running Shop. It's a new running shop at Kimball Junction. So you can go there ahead of time to get your race bib, your number, and that helps day of to get there sooner and not line up as much.
And what was the website again?
Parkcityss.org. So it's basically short for Park City Ski and Snowboard.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming in. We've been speaking with Park City Ski and Snowboard Cross Country Director Emma Garrard.
Thank you, Parker.
Yeah, have a good one. I'm now joined in studio by KPCW's Director of Development, Sarah Irvin. Hey, Sarah.
Good morning, Parker.
I also have Jake Nelson on the phone. He is an associate professor in the Communications Department at the University of Utah. How's it going, Jake?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. We're here to talk about the threats to funding, specifically, obviously, to public media. I think, Sarah, I'll just turn to you for a quick recap. I mean, what is kind of the situation as it stands today?
Yeah, thank you, Parker. So, we are watching closely what's happening in Washington here at KPCW and at public radio and public television stations around the country. We're very concerned about the most recent threat to public media funding, which comes in the form of a rescission memo that the White House sent to Congress, urging them to repeal or claw back previously approved funds for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This contains $1.1 billion. That's 2 years worth of funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And Congress has essentially 45 days from receipt of that memo, which was earlier this week, to act. And we understand that the House might vote as soon as next week. So, you know, we're certainly urging folks who are concerned about cuts to public media, like cuts to KPCW, to make their voices heard.
And I understand it would it be about 14% of our budget if those funds were taken?
Yes, and we budget 2 years in advance, knowing that these funds are approved 2 years in advance. So typically KPCW receives about $264,000 in community service grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We've budgeted around that for this coming fiscal year and the fiscal year beyond that. We would have to make up that deficit. It is about 14% of our operating budget.
Yeah, Jake, I wanted to turn it over to you. I know you do a lot of research in how the journalism interacts with the public and society at large. I mean, when you just think about potential loss of funding for particularly rural stations that maybe serve an area that don't have tons of news sources, I mean, what do you see as the lingering results of that?
So I think that there are two really big issues. The first is just the most obvious one, which is the lack in information that becomes available to people living in these communities. You know, the less news that they have available to them, the less informed they are, the more susceptible they become to misinformation that gets shared on social media. And so that very obvious issue is the one that I think is getting a great deal of attention, and for good reason. I think the other one, and this is one that comes up in a lot of the research that I'm doing, which draws on interviews with members of the public about how they feel about and where they get their news from, is that the less available local news becomes to people, it seems the more likely they are to get almost all of their news from cable news. And as I'm sure you all know, you know, there's a very big difference in terms of what you're getting and how informed you become about your local community when you're getting your news primarily from cable news rather than from your local community news organization. And in addition to that difference in terms of what the information looks like, it also really affects people's perceptions of the news industry more broadly. Because if their news is coming primarily from these sources that feel very disconnected from their daily lives and from the issues that are actually embroiling their communities, they tend to have much more negative perceptions of journalists because they just feel like those journalists aren't invested in their lives in the same way that, say, a journalist working for a local news organization, a publicly funded news organization would be.
Yeah, and I assume there are a fair amount of communities where cable local TV news is really their sole source, unless they maybe have something else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't really speak to, like, the actual rates at which these sources are the primary sources. But what I can say is that for months now, I've been doing interviews with a representative sample of the U.S. public. And whenever I ask just generally, how do you feel about the news or where do you get your news? The answers are almost always start at least with CNN, Fox, MSNBC. And then from there, the sort of local ABC, CBS, whatever affiliate. Some people then go to their local news organizations, but for a lot of people, it's those big sources that are sort of like defining what news is. And I think that, like I said before, it sort of gives people a very different perception of what journalists do and how committed journalists are to their communities than if, say, their news was coming primarily from sources that were emerging from and more invested in the communities that they live in.
Yeah, you know, I feel like the common narrative for some time has been that public confidence in journalism and journalists and news organizations has declined. Do you still see that largely in your research?
Yes. The short answer is yes, that trust in news is declining. And I think that it is related to this broader perception of news as stemming primarily from what people see on cable news from these very large organizations. And the reason for that, at least from what I can tell from these interviews that I've been doing, is that people don't really know how journalism gets paid for. They don't really know much about the funding models behind news organizations. And it leads people to some very deep skepticism about how journalists are balancing the profit motivations of the organizations and the more ideological missions to serve the public. And I actually think that this is like a huge advantage of public media in that your organizations tend to be very, very upfront with the public. Here is how we make our money. Here is what we need from you to survive, to keep going, to serve you. And that actually, from my perspective, starts this conversation that is very, very much needed with the public about how journalism gets paid for and how that money does and does not affect news coverage.
Yeah, and going back to you.
Yeah, I just want to jump on something there, Jake, that you said, and that has to do with public accountability. The fact that we receive money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and, you know, public media stations around the country, we are held accountable. We have to report on that money every year back to, you know, Congress and to the general public about how we use those taxpayer dollars. We are incredibly accountable to our local community, and we are not, you know, like you said, profit driven. And I think that's a huge difference. And that is something that we are not news for entertainment the way that a lot of those cable news networks are. And that's why we're so vital to local communities.
And Jake, I was curious if you've done any research just in the nonprofit news space, whether they're NPR public stations or not. I mean, just if you had anything to share on just the health of these organizations over the last few years.
You know, I haven't done research into those types of organizations specifically. The research that I've done, even when it sort of touched on these types of organizations, has been, unfortunately, because I think that this is such a pressing issue, less focused on their economic challenges and more focused on how their economic models impact the ways in which they interact with their audiences. Mm-hmm. And my impression from the research that I've done is that it does really lead to a much more audience community focused approach when the money that you need to survive is coming primarily from the public. And also, as you mentioned, when you're a nonprofit, when your goal is explicitly not just to make money, but primarily to serve the public, it's one of those things where, you know, like just me saying it out loud, it sounds so obvious. You know, if you're not trying to make money as the end all be all, then like, okay, probably you're going to be a little bit more focused on serving the people that you seek to serve. But it is actually true. and it's worth saying that, especially at this moment where that funding is in jeopardy, because it really does matter to have news organizations that are so much more explicitly focused on communities, both in terms of the quality of the news that they're producing for those local communities, but also, as I mentioned before, when it comes to really hoping to improve people's perceptions of journalism more broadly.
Yeah, Sarah, anything you want to share just on what the station is doing amid
Sure.
the funding cuts?
Yes, I'd love to encourage listeners to learn more. We have a federal funding page on our website right now. If you go to kpcw.org and click the Protect Public Media button there on the right rail, you can learn a lot more about how KPCW uses Corporation for Public Broadcasting funds, how CPB operates in general, and what the threats currently are. And again, how folks can reach out to their members of Congress if they have concerns.
Yeah. We've been speaking with KPCW's Director of Development, Sarah Irvin, and Jake Nelson at the University of Utah. Thanks, you two, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jake.
Thank you.
Longtime Vail Resorts executive Rob Katz retook the helm as CEO during the company's third earnings call yesterday. Katz took over as CEO in late May after serving as chair of Vail Resorts' board of directors. During the company's earnings call Thursday, Katz was asked about selling Park City Mountain. This was his response.
No, that's not something that we're looking at. And we don't think that that ultimately is in the right long-term interest of our company. We think it's, you know, especially a resort like Park City, of course, is critical to our overall company and our network.
Park City resident Matthew Prince, the billionaire CEO of cybersecurity firm Cloudflare, recently told KPCW he approached Vail about acquiring the mountain. Katz also commented on the Park City Ski Patrol strike, which rattled operations during the holiday season. The CEO said guest satisfaction scores at Vail properties were strong during the previous ski season, excluding Park City Mountain.
The Park City experience was obviously unacceptable.
Epic Pass sales for the upcoming season through May 27th are down 1% compared to the same period the prior year. However, sales revenue from those Epic Passes are up 2% year over year, following the product's 7% price increase. You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. Thanks for tuning in.